Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're going to talk a little bit about Social Security, gentrification, and I'm sure many other things that have been roiling this whole news cycle all week long. But before we can move on, Republicans in general, and Donald Trump in particular, currently have always argued that their budget plans, which result in massive slashing of social programs, scientific research, and basically anything that isn't the military, can help unleash competitiveness in the U.S. economy when paired with massive tax cuts for rich people, and also, of course, that it will reduce the budget deficit, the perennial hobby horse of the right wing. Well, the Congressional Budget Office has now come in with a report on Trump's proposed budget, and surprise, surprise, it does not lower the budget deficit, or increase economic growth. According to the CBO, the economy would grow 1.9% a year, which is below the 3% forecast by the White House when they presented the budget. Further, rather than creating a surplus, the CBO states that the deep cuts to various government programs will result in a $720 billion deficit. This makes Trump's attempt to make his proposed budget the general outline for Republicans in Congress, where the budget actually originates, given that the stated goals of their party probably won't be met. Again, it makes it a little bit difficult. Further, for moderate Republicans, particularly those facing re-election next year, the complete elimination and gutting of numerous popular and effective government programs won't seem very palatable if they can't point to other gains that would come from it. Ultimately, Republicans' wholesale of their policies to people, which really is that ultimately, a rising economy is going to lift all boats, so you don't have to worry about, say, funding affordable housing because everyone will be able to buy a house. However, without a huge surge in the economic prospects of the country, this isn't happening. Undoubtedly, the CBO score will give House Republicans pause as they prepare a budget since, just like healthcare, pursuing Republican orthodoxy has sent them into a tailspin that could potentially lose them control of the Senate in 2018. So on the budget, it seems likely to assume they may move away a little bit from that orthodoxy towards the more moderate members. But of course, it's worth noting, that would still mean a budget with draconian budget cuts. And in fact, maybe this is one of the most important things to overarch over all of this. People are talking about quote-unquote moderate Republicans as if they are somehow Bernie Sanders or somebody. Really, it's just that the Tea Party types have pulled Republicans so far to the right that even adherence to the most basic standards of human decency seem like significant support for government action to help people. So the CBO score could lead to an excellent bait and switch where Republicans can construct a little morality play here where the moderates scold the hard right, and then a budget is passed that eviscerates a number of programs but is portrayed in the media as quote-unquote moderate and is portrayed by liberals as a victory over Trump while many people continue to be screwed. Having your cake and eating it too, I think that's called. We've talked a lot about how the swamp is really not being drained at all. In fact, it seems to actually be a golden era for corporate interests in America. And, you know, whatever, regardless of which party is in power, obviously corporate interests reign supreme. However, Democrats are the pro-corporate party that fear this kind of outright profiteering without any semblance of a human face. I mean, you know, anything could happen. People might rise up. And the type of resistance that isn't easily contained by political parties. Republicans, however, are willing to just throw the barn doors open and let in every single terrible thing that could ever be done with their completely mythical pro-market ethos that create a lot of smoke and mirrors around what they're actually doing to tricking people into believing that they will benefit because the economy will get better, but ultimately they won't unless they're a rich business owner. So putting all this together, you might not be surprised to learn that big tobacco, yup, they're back, has put almost all of its eggs in the Republican basket recently, and that has been paying off since Trump has ascended to the White House. Reynolds American donated $1.5 million to Trump's inaugural $1 million to Trump's inaugural festivities. The Altria Group chipped in about $500,000 more. And in the first quarter of this year alone, Big Tobacco spent almost $5 million in lobbying congressional officials. So what have they gotten so far? Well, twice already, the FDA has delayed court cases where they were supposed to defend new regulations on e-cigarettes, and summer deadlines for cigar and e-cigarette makers to file paperwork with the FDA around various regulations, well, also postponed. No surprise that one of the things that popped into the Republican healthcare bill as well was a $126 million cut to a CDC program that educates people about the harms of tobacco use. Also, Trump has ensconced in his administration many people with deep ties to the tobacco industry among, you know, other terrible industries. Tom Price, the Secretary for Health and Human Services, voted against a 62-cent cigarette tax hike in 2009 that was designed to help pay for health care for poor children. He also just had just about over $30,000 in Altria stock, and now that he has ascended to HHS, his former deputy chief of staff has just been hired by Reynolds American as a lobbyist. Scott Gottlieb, he's the administrator of the FDA, worked just before the government at an investment firm that raised close to $5 million for one e-cigarette firm. 11 lawyers from Jones Day, which is one of the tobacco industry's go-to, are now working in various administration roles. Well, on top of that, the nation's top lawyer, the Solicitor General Noel Francisco, directly represented Reynolds American, who argued it, and he argued in court, cigarette packages should not be forced to put a phone number on there that the people could call for help to quit smoking. Of course, Vice President Mike Pence was a good friend of Big Tobacco as a congressman. He once penned an op-ed in the year 2000, which stated that, quote, smoking doesn't kill. Mitch McConnell's chief of staff also hired as an Altria lobbyist in January. McConnell also has been active for Big Tobacco in his time in the Senate. It's also worth noting here while we're talking about it, House Speaker Paul Ryan took $70,000 from the tobacco industry in 2016. And I know I left those Democrats a little bit off the hook earlier, but worth noting here, Mark Warner, Tim Kaine, Michael Bennett, all Democratic senators were in the top 20 recipients of tobacco industry money in the year 2016. Wait, what else did Tim Kaine do that year? Vice presidential candidate for Hillary Clinton. So despite smoking being the number one cause of preventable death in America, killing thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people, their interests seem quite secure in Trump's America. In a fairly remarkable series of votes yesterday, the House of Representatives in a bipartisan fashion delivered a strong rebuke to U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen. The House passed one amendment that prohibits the U.S. military action not authorized by the 2001 authorization of use of military force. Specifically, then, this amendment would end the refueling of Saudi and UAE warplanes in the war in Yemen. The House passed another amendment prohibiting the employment of U.S. troops in the war in Yemen, which, of course, would also hobble some of this Air Force-to-Air Force cooperation. Now, the passing of these two amendments, of course, will still have to go through a couple more steps before they can actually become law, but clearly the widespread revulsion at the Saudi war in Yemen is starting to have an effect on Congress. Over the past several months, more and more congressional officials have been speaking out, and now these amendments, it's important to note, would still allow the anti-Al-Qaeda actions in Yemen, which objectively does help the Saudis, but nevertheless, it's clearly the sternest rebuke of the Saudi war so far from U.S. officials. And there's an important context here as well. We also recently saw the U.S. Conference of Mayors reject Trump's plan to shift roughly $50 billion to the Pentagon from social programs in his proposed budget. And while it's too early to draw deep conclusions from this, it seems clear that the general sentiments of anger at U.S. wars abroad and the excesses of the military-industrial complex, while unorganized, is something politicians are seeing can help them score some political points. And these votes come at a pretty interesting time as it regards these sentiments, given a new study that just came out last week that ties Clinton's presidential loss to anger at the never-ending war machine, which during the campaign, you remember, Trump was highly critical of. The report is titled, quote, Battlefield Casualties and Ballot Box Defeat, Did the Bush-Obama Wars Cost Clinton the White House, end quote. And the study itself is a little bit complicated, but essentially they found what they believe to be strong evidence suggesting that the areas that gained the most Republican votes from 2012 to 2016 had higher casualty rates in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that that was the key factor. We will try to go more in depth on this study next week, but it's worth noting for now that it's clear the blowback from wars and occupations abroad is starting to creep into the American body politic. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are happy to continue our conversation here with Jasmine Jefferson, who's the Legislative Director for Social Security Works. Jasmine, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me back.
So I wanted to start with the big news as it concerns Social Security, at least, which is the new Social Security Trustees Report. This is basically tells you what the status of Social Security is. What was in this report?
So the very short version of what's in the report is that Social Security continues to be strong. It's solvent for several years until about 2034 is what the trustees predict. Just for a little bit of background, the group of trustees is made up of a bunch of secretaries. So the Secretary of HHS, the Secretary of Treasury is the lead of them. Also, the Commissioner of SSA is a part of that group. And so they come together and they do the analysis to figure out, along with a lot of smart people, a lot of economists, actuaries, people like that, to figure out what Social Security is going to look like. So they can make reasonable predictions, right? And so, like we said, it's strong. It's solvent until 2034. It continues to have a surplus about $2.9 trillion, which is quite a lot of money, even in D.C. That's a lot. That's a lot for Congress to deal with. So $2.9 trillion. People will receive their benefits in full. Like I said, until 2034 and beyond that, we can still have benefits up to at least 85%. And the good news, the even better news, is that we could do something about that, which is what we work for at Social Security Works, to expand Social Security.
And I'm glad you said that, because I actually I know there's some bills in Congress around the issue of expansion. I think one of them has quite a number of the largest number of co-sponsors it's ever had. So talk to us a little bit about the efforts that, I mean, I think people may be generally familiar with the idea that people are trying to expand Social Security. But what are some of the things we could do? How could we expand it? And who on the Hill is doing something about it?
Yeah, so I'll start with the bill that you referred to, Representative John Larson. He's the ranking member on the Social Security Subcommittee in the House of Representatives. He's from Connecticut, and he's introduced a bill he calls the Social Security 2100 Act. That bill, along with several others that have been introduced in Congress, can do a series of things to make sure, like we said, Social Security is solvent beyond 2034. So just to start with a few things that are in his bill, one thing that's notable, I think, for a lot of seniors, they're familiar with the concept of having a cost of living adjustment. Mm. So the cost of living adjustment currently is calculated by a set formula, and it calculates the amount of goods that an urban wage worker, the goods that they use. That's how the COLA is calculated. Mm. So at the beginning of the year, the Social Security beneficiaries receive an increase based on that basket of goods. One thing that Representative Larson does is he changes how that basket of goods is calculated based on the goods that a senior would be more likely to use, such as healthcare costs, which we know are very high. Seniors are not as likely to use gasoline, for example, less on transportation. So we would lower the amount that is counted in that basket of goods. So one thing he does is use the CPIE. It is an estimated value. It exists. They could use that to estimate the benefits for seniors, and they would see a significant increase in their benefits. So that's just one thing. Another thing, Bernie Sanders has a great bill in the Senate, and one way that he decides to increase revenue, because of course that's part of the issue, we have to increase revenue, he taxes investment income. Mm. Currently, only your earned income is included in Social Security. And so everyone who works a normal job, mm-hmm. pays 6.2% of their income into Social Security. And so that's what funds FICA. Benefits. Yes, that is your FICA tax that you see. And everyone's familiar with what is this FICA tax for. But that goes towards your Social Security benefit. So Social Security is an earned benefit. It's something that you're going to get back. So don't fret too much about your 6.2%. You'll see it when you turn around 65, 67, depending on your age. But anyways, the investment income that the millionaires and billionaires of the world, like our president, Donald Trump, the investment income is not taxed. So anything that you make off of your own money, you're not paying 6.2% of any of that income. And of course, that's unfair for the rest of us who are paying 6.2% on our entire income. So we definitely... we endorse that proposal. Social Security Works does endorse Representative Larson's proposal as well. And there's several other things you could do to increase benefits, to make sure that revenue is steadily coming into the program, and that we can see the program solvent from 2034 and 50 years and 100 years and however long until our children and grandchildren are able to receive their benefits.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, going one level deeper on Senator Sanders' bill, because I think that's certainly a good idea and right in line with the idea of raising the cap. I know the $90,000 cap. But since the way it is now, from what I understand, is like what you pay in is what you get back. Do you have to change so if you tax investment income, is that just into the general Social Security fund to expand benefits overall? Or will that increase the benefits for the people who are paying in?
So ideally, that would increase benefits for everyone. So how Social Security works right now is that we do not have private accounts. So what you put in is not exactly what you're going to get out. Your benefit depends on how much money it is. It's based on how much money you put in. But there is a minimum benefit. There is a maximum benefit. Mm. So currently, if, say, the maximum benefit does not change, then people who are wealthy and will get more out of the system are not going to get any more out of the system if they already receive the maximum benefit. It's all just regulated based on how much you have put into the system. Now, ideally, at Social Security Works, we do endorse raising benefits for everyone because, you know, if you put in more, you can have more out of the system. But there are people who Social Security is all they have to retire on. And so it's so incredibly important to talk about increasing benefits across the board, you know, just not for the wealthiest. We're not going to put tax investment income and only give money to the wealthiest. We are going to tax investment income and bring everybody up.
I'm actually glad you said that, the sort of one-to-one matching there, because I wasn't sure. And that's an interesting point because people didn't know this before, but it seems like a very profound statement about these people who want to privatize Social Security. It just seems like the only result would be intense income inequality then, if like there's basically a formula that's paying it out based on something realistic. If it's just what you put in to this health saver or private savings Social Security account, if you aren't rich with a lot of investments or have money to invest, you basically are going to be in the poorhouse as a senior citizen.
That is true. I mean, that is what we had before Social Security. So before before we've seen the system where we're used to it now, right? We're used to seeing, well, we get the 6.2% taken out. It wasn't always like that. So before the Depression, before FDR created this program, people were in the streets. Seniors were in the streets. Seniors were going back to live with their children. They couldn't live independently. They didn't have an income beyond what they made, unless they had, say, a pension. But as we know, pensions are currently under attack. Unions are not what they used to be. So pensions have gone away. 401ks, they are, as we saw in 2008, they can be quite unreliable. If you wanted to retire in 2008, you might have changed your plans because the stock market does what it does. It goes up, it goes down, and continues on as such. So we have to have something more stable, more dependable, and that's what makes Social Security so important.
Well, and about a minute here, but I want to just say quickly, since a lot of this report is done by different secretaries and individuals who are a part of the Trump administration, I mean, any expectation, they've sort of hinted that they may be open to some Social Security privatization. Trump himself is not, but some of those people in the administration. Does this give you more hope that perhaps inside the White House, at least, there might not be a lot of appetite for privatizing Social Security?
Yeah, I think they're not on the same page about what they want to do. The president has so far stood pretty strong about what he wants to do. But like you said, he's surrounding himself with people who are not, they're not clear about where they stand, or they are clear. They want to privatize. So since they're not on the same page, maybe we'll be like Congress. They won't do anything for a while.
Well, you know, in some ways, that might be the least harmful thing they could do. Well, we are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are here continuing our conversation with Jasmine Jefferson, who's the Legislative Director for Social Security Works. And we are very happy to be joined now by Ari Teresa, who is an attorney with Stoop Law here in the District of Columbia. Thank you both for staying with us. And Jasmine, we left off talking a little bit about Social Security. There was one thing I didn't want to leave on the table here, since there's a lot of discussion about the new Senate health care bill. And this was controversial the last time around, is that Republicans were saying, well, we're not going to do anything to cut Social Security, but they were cutting Social Security disability benefits. Did they change that in this new version?
So I have not seen anything that would affect Social Security in the health care bill, but there are several people who receive Social Security and Medicare. There are people who receive Social Security and Medicaid. And so Social Security Works, therefore, fights for all of those programs. We can't allow people who are living just on Social Security to now not have health care coverage. The people who have Social Security, imagine if they have, we'll say average benefits about $1,400. What if now they have to pay their health care premiums because they can't afford they don't have Medicare anymore to coverage them, because they're, regardless of this new bill that they have, there are going to be millions of people who lose their health care coverage. So I just want to talk a little bit about the vote, if that's okay.
No, please.
Yeah. So currently there are three senators that we need to say no to health care in order for this bill to fail, in order for, and I hate to call it health care bill because it's not really health care. The concept is to take health care away from people. So we'll call it Trump care for now. So in order to make sure that Trump care fails, we need three Senate Republicans to vote no on this bill. And currently there are two. So Senator Rand Paul is super conservative and says that he is opposed to this bill because it doesn't repeal Obamacare completely, which, whatever, we'll take his vote. And then there's Senator Susan Collins from Maine. She is very concerned, of course, about the seniors in her state. She's concerned about the Medicaid recipients. She's concerned about several other things and has already stated up front that on Tuesday she will not be voting to proceed with the vote on this bill. So that's great. There are two senators who have been clear. There are several other senators who in the past have said that they were going to vote no, and which is why the vote failed, or didn't fail, but we never got to a vote a few weeks ago. And now they have become undecided. They might be waiting on the CBO score. I'm not sure. But if anyone lives in Nevada, Dean Heller, he is vulnerable. He is up for re-election in 2018. He is someone who said no before. His governor has already said that he knows that this won't be good for the people of his state. So Senator Heller is in quite a predicament. He needs to vote no in order to please his governor, to please his constituents. But he says he's undecided. So I think he needs to feel some pressure from the outside in order for this to fail, because I think we have to realize this is, if it passes the Senate, it's going to go back to the House. It's going to pass the House, and the President Trump's going to sign it. Mm-hmm. Bottom line. So we got to stop this weekend. This is all the time we have to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and I think a lot of pressure may come from governors this weekend. Apparently Vice President Pence spoke at a governor's thing today and said, we're going to repeal the ACA. And there was, as I saw it described in the media, tepid applause from the governors there for obvious reasons, because they've seen the benefits their own populations have gotten and the benefits to their electoral fortunes. But I want to switch gears here, and I'm glad, Jasmine, that you actually came to us just off of Capitol Hill lobbying, doing your legislative director thing, because it speaks to sort of the underlying reality of the next thing I want to bring up, which is this Aramis Ayala situation, the state attorney in Orlando. So for those who don't know, she's a state's attorney in Orlando. She was the first black state's attorney in Florida. She's also, you may have heard her name, in a big controversy with the governor over not pursuing the death penalty. So this video comes out, I think it was a body cam video. She's pulled over in her car by these cops. They come up to the window, and so she questions them and was just like, well, why did you all pull me over? And she's doing her thing, hands over the license or whatever. The best part, though, is the cop is like real, you know, cop like pulling you over, and then looks at her and goes, oh, and she's like, yeah, I'm the state's attorney. And then he changes his whole attitude. But then she says, well, why'd you pull me over? And he's fumbling around and he says, oh, well, we run tags all the time, blah, blah, blah. So the question, there's a lot to this, but the question I want to ask you, Jasmine, which I think is very relevant, it's just difficult for me to believe that you would run a plate, a cop like that, and see a name that's like a famous name of a state's attorney who was white in a place like that, and still pull them over just to check if it was a stolen car. So as a black professional woman, I wondered how you felt seeing another black professional woman in this sort of situation.
Yeah. So myself and my coworker, Ebony, also a black professional woman, we were looking at this yesterday in the office, and we were just like, oh my goodness. It just doesn't matter how far you make it. You can still get pulled over and look suspicious for driving a nice car. It's just another time. It just means we're still in this place where in America you can be black and still not be good enough.
You know, I think it's a good point. And, you know, Ari, the thing about it that really like just fired me up, it was the dude's explanation. And then he was like, well, we just run tags all the time. And then I saw some attorney writing in like the Daily Beast who was like, yeah, you know, I'm not saying that this was right, but I mean, the police do run tags all the time. And I'm just thinking, Well, what is that even like? Okay, so basically what you're saying is there's racial profiling. Like, they're just looking at cars and looking at people and being like, I'm about to run that tag. Like, I doubt they're just rolling around running tags of people who look like quote-unquote upstanding country club people in Orlando or whatever. I mean, the whole thing to me was wild that that could even be a justification. But your thoughts?
I guess my thoughts on this are, in 2017, I'm not shocked by it. And, I mean, I guess it's progress to me that he even believed that she was state's attorney.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess that's where I'm at with it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. The whole thing was, the other thing was that her windows were too tinted. And I was like, this is Florida. Have y'all ever been to Florida? Everybody has tinted windows. It's an interesting point, though, I thought, to see that how the cop's attitude changed, too, as soon as he found out who she was and got real concerned and was like, I'm going to give you my card, and just sort of like the ingrained biases. But perhaps there is at least a little progress that he was shook to some degree moving forward. But, you know, speaking of different perceptions of people, the other thing that's sort of in the air, so yes, yesterday or 2 days ago, the Trump opioid task force missed its second deadline to release its report. Now, you know, hey, whatever. But the task force is coming. And I hope people do a lot to deal with the opioid crisis. I think it's terrible. Obviously, it was motivated by big pharmaceuticals to a large degree. They're making a huge amount of money. So I'm not trying to be down on people using heroin or, you know, addicted to opioids or whatever. But it does seem, and Ari, I'll start with you. It does seem to me like, man, when crack was popping, it was like no sense of understanding at all. It was just like crazy, crazed, cracked out zombies killing people, put them all in jail. Now it's like, wow, we got to show concern, compassion. And it, I mean, hey, maybe I'm overstepping my bounds to say it seems racially motivated.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Again, it's no shock to me that when white people suffer from this, that it's a health issue, but when it's black people, it's a criminal issue. Yeah, no shocker.
Even just because opioid funding was the thing that got thrown around in this new version of the healthcare bill. So somehow, even in the Senate, this is a concern. This is a real problem. And I feel like if it was a black people problem, then they would be throwing money maybe at the police force to try to, you know, lock people up or do something different. They want to do something related to justice instead of something related to being, you know, fair, doing something that will heal people from their illness rather than to criminalize them.
Well, it seems like it almost has like a too big to fail aspect to it, too. As we know, Eric Holder told the DEA, stop looking at Big Pharma when they were doing this. And it's just sort of like, you know, they'll go with a million cops and the DEA and kingpin laws and whatever when they're going to arrest drug dealers. But then when it comes to the power of Big Pharma, you know, in Congress, in the White House, in American politics, then since they are the real drug dealers here, everyone's looking the other way.
Yeah, that's something we have worked other than Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. We work really extensively into lowering the price of prescription drugs, just to clarify. But
that could bring down the market price overall, though.
Yeah, just to clarify, prescription drugs. But yeah, Big Pharma is, I mean, it's almost magical. We could write a member of Congress about something concerning lowering drug prices. And if Big Pharma does not agree with our stance, they have the money to send in like 2 and 3 lobbyists per member of Congress. They control a lot. And so the same way you said in this opioid crisis, they're I'm sure doing something similar to make sure that they make money. It doesn't have anything to do with saving lives. They've gone against what they say they stand for, which is helping people. They're about making money.
Mm-hmm. Well, McKesson, which is the largest distributor of pharmaceuticals, is also the fifth largest corporation in America, $192 billion. In revenue. So it gives you some sense of the scale of what's going on. And again, that's just one company. You don't know that much about it really at all, because no one talks about pharmaceutical distributors in a big way. They talk a little bit about the manufacturers. But nevertheless, we will see when the commission whenever it does decide to do its work, led by Chris Christie, by the way. Maybe that's why they were delayed. He was at the beach, you know, he was chilling, closed it down. I don't know 100% what was going on with him, but I think it's a relevant point. I mean, I think, you know, the one other thing it reminds me of, Ari, too, is Eric Holder himself. Since I referenced him, it just popped into my mind, and the whole too big to fail thing with Wall Street. And it's sort of like, I don't know, it seems like the ultimate parable for America, that some Wall Street bank is too big to fail, but like all black communities in America that have been devastated by drug dealing, like, no big deal if they fail.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the failure of black communities is almost tied into America's economy. Mm. So these things are not by accident. And when we see it happen, it's something that's by design. Mm. You know, when we see the community being attacked on these fronts, with arresting people for these kinds of criminalities using drugs, whereas if it's another kind of community, it's a health issue. These things are not by accident.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you said by design, because I want to ask you a causation question. You know, because what that made me think of is this new book by James Forman Jr. about drug policy in America. The quick capsule view for our listeners is he wrote this book detailing how black communities over the years had made, I don't know how to call it, had been pushing for stronger, tougher drug laws. So I think the point he's trying to make in the book is that sort of black communities are also partially responsible for mass incarceration, and that like that kind of quote unquote painful history has to be dealt with. The book is getting rave reviews. I haven't read the book, so that could be partially, I don't know, but there's been a few books in the past couple of years along the same lines about the importance of recognizing this. And, you know, I wrote my own book, Shackled and Chained, Mass Incarceration in Capitalist America. And certainly I pointed out how the CBC and others have played a negative role. But this seems to go one step further, and it just seems to not really ring true to me.
I mean, it doesn't to me either. And the first question I had in my mind when you brought that up is, well, I wonder how much money they made off of that. How much money did the black community make off of incarcerating black people? Because it wasn't them making money. Mm. And in the line of work that I'm in, I see people acting against their interests in black communities all the time. And a lot of the time, it's the result of being taken advantage of, being exploited economically. And so, like, it's almost like it's not an equal field. Like, if you're looking at two parties, And you say, you have to ask, did this party really have agency when they made that decision? Mm. And I think our communities are so just attacked on all fronts that a lot of the decisions that we make as a community, you know, are not really decisions that would be made if we were on equal footing. Mm. With the people we're negotiating with.
Well, that's, I think that's 100% true. I mean, it goes back a little bit to, Jasmine, to something we were discussing earlier, even in just the conception of who's getting Social Security, or the fact that some people have Medicaid and Medicare, of this sort of, I mean, the whole idea of like entitlement programs. I mean, it's almost it's as if like some secret interest group of poor people somehow secretly inserted into the government billions of dollars of money coming back to them, and they're just like hanging out getting rich. I mean, it doesn't even really make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. People say that about Social Security disability insurance beneficiaries all the time. First of all, they've earned their benefit, whether they are of color or not. They earn their benefit. And people have this image of what a disability recipient looks like. So they're like, oh, well, they just have back pain and they can go to work. And the image is always probably a black man who isn't at work during the week. Mm. That is what everyone thinks. But you don't actually know what his disability might be. Mental illness is, in fact, that is a disability. You don't know what his back is like, and you don't know what jobs in the market he could have had or that he had before and that he can go do now. And so no one's getting rich off a disability. I don't know any of those people. No one's getting rich off Medicare or Medicaid. And all of those are things that are there for when you cannot work or for when you don't have health care. We have a system in place for a reason, but, you know, like you said, when someone has an image of someone, of a person who looks a certain, not like them, a person who looks not like them, they have a problem magically, and it's entitlement. But when it's just another person, someone not of color, well, you know, it's there for me. I earned it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm glad you used that example. I knew a guy once who they went after his disability insurance because some other person who he worked with called to report fraud because I guess the guy knew he had like season tickets to a minor league baseball team. And the guy was like, well, if your back really was so bad, how could you possibly like sit at a baseball game for 9 innings, like in this many games or whatever, and said, this is fraud, and reported him. And they did like a legit investigation into him because of someone saying he was sitting at a baseball game and was like not truly injured. And I just thought to myself at the time and since, like, you got to have a perverse view or like a quote unquote welfare queen view to even think that there's like who are all these people who are out here committing Social Security? You got to give so many forms you got to fill out to get all these. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, most people are denied their disability insurance the first time that they apply. And like we said, no one's getting rich. The process is hard. We have some of the hardest requirements in the world. That story is just, I mean, ideal. And I'm really surprised whoever it was that reported them actually took the time to do it. I mean, like, they really must have been upset about this, like, right. Really mad about it. Right. But again, yeah, your point proves true.
Well, Ari, you do a lot of work with public housing residents, and it reminds me of that thing that I know you've heard this a million times. Well, so I know so-and-so lives in public housing, but they got a flat screen TV.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, the biggest recipients of subsidy in Washington, D.C. are probably millennial white people, college grads, graduates in the 60 AMI housing luxury apartment buildings, paying $1,200 a month on double subsidy from the government, subsidy from their parents, in their first job out of college or grad school, enjoying U Street, not knowing anything about the history. And talking about people in public housing with a flat screen television that they attained. I mean,
probably at Aaron's.
Yeah, maybe at Aaron's, maybe at Goodwill. Who knows? Why were they even in the public housing to know that they have a public housing television with that attitude? I don't know.
There you go. People got to look up rent to own in this joint, man. It's extremely predatory. Anyway, we're going to take another break. We're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our conversation here with Ari Teresa from Stoop Law here in Washington, D.C., and we are joined by Bob Schlehuber here for this last segment here, who is a Sputnik News analyst. Bob, thanks for jumping in here.
My pleasure.
And Ari, I wanted to start, and as many people who are listening know, we are live on 105.5 in the Washington, D.C. area. So I wanted to start here, Ari, with a interesting Washington, D.C. story. So Wallet Hub, I don't even know what that is, but some sort of website, has prepared a list of cities on basically how they are doing in terms of being run and a couple other things. Anyway, long story short, Washington, D.C. was ranked the worst run city in the United States, which I thought, like, man, that's pretty intense. Your thoughts as someone who interacts in a decent amount with D.C. government, is that fair, unfair, or kind of a bizarre ranking? What do you think?
I mean, I don't know the criterion for the study. I didn't check that out, but it definitely jibes with my experience working with the D.C. government. I'm an attorney. I've worked in a lot of administrative law cases. And I can tell you that the agencies leave very much to be desired in terms of their interpretations of statutes and staying in accord with the law. Right. So I stay very busy.
Bob, I'm curious your thoughts on this. Interesting things here. I mean, some of the things they've pointed out here, long-term debt is the highest long-term debt of any city tied with five other cities. Fourth lowest graduation rate, eighth best city for infrastructure and pollution. So I guess some good things. But basically, it looks like they factor the quality of city services and the city's total budget, and they've come up with this ranking. Does it sound about right to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think on two ends, it's kind of a weird confluence of cities here. There's two separate cities. I mean, this is Mario Cuomo's great Tale of Two Cities that talks about how there's a lower income class in Washington, D.C. that's abused in every ways by poverty that are influencing a lot of these negative statistical drivers. And then mixed then with a highly populated, wealthy luxury condo class that has all of these great assets. But then when they're kind of merged together, it gives you really weird data that's not interpreted properly if you don't kind of step back and say, wow, there's two dramatically different cities here in the nation's capital. Huge divide between those who have and have not. So the numbers, I think, on any of these studies, when they're kind of just a flyover study, let's grab a bunch of data points, isn't going to speak to the fact that the city is wonderful if you're making a lot of money, if you're of a certain color, if you get certain protection by the police and you get certain tax breaks and different incentives to do business. It's a great city. We see people flourish in the city, driving nice cars, living in big houses and taking advantage of that. It is an absolutely horrible city if you're low income or abused by the systems and structures of race and class in the United States. And then I think the second thing that drives me more just nuts is last week, somebody on the Washington metropolitan area transit authority came out against a city council member and saying the council member was trying to stop the high arrest rates and fines on those who skip their metro fares. And the WMATA board member basically said,
WMATA
board member said, this is costing us so much money, people skipping over these. Well, today, one of the lead engineers got fired from the track fixes because he was abusing overtime hours and was cashing in paychecks and saying he was working all these hours when he actually wasn't. So we're often seeing these high-ranking administrators, high-ranking professionals that are supposed to run the public services getting high six-figure paychecks. They're abusing overtime laws. And so, yeah, you're going to get a poorly run city when the wealthiest are continuing to abuse this.
Well, I mean, and I think, Ari, it brings the case to, like, who really runs and who really controls the city, too. I mean, you work a lot around development issues. I mean, I would certainly argue that in Washington, D.C., and that's what I would say most major cities are, the agenda is really not driven by what, quote-unquote, voters want, even if that's how it's portrayed. But it's really, what are the economic drivers in that area? And here it is development. And so everything is subsumed to real estate developers, construction companies, and whatever, continuing their gravy train.
Yeah. And I'm just going to add to that. I think that this is global in the age that we're living in. We see it everywhere. The policies that were implemented here are being implemented in South America now. So this is a part of the neoliberalism that we're seeing. And just the, like you said, the economic drivers, and it's not just the local ones, it's part of a global scheme. And how can we make D.C. fit into what's happening within the world? And to that extent, the people who are local don't matter.
I think that's a good point, a very good point. And I want to get your thoughts on one of the related issue on homelessness about this, because one thing that's been happening a lot in D.C. is the quote unquote cleaning or clearing really of homeless encampments. And I said on a post I did on Facebook that even really calling these sort of just like homeless people out doing whatever, even people experiencing homelessness didn't feel right to me. I said, this is really an informal settlement, because when you're reading the interview with the people, they're talking about, well, we are here because it's safer for us and we know these people, we like these people, we're building bonds and community. And it just seems to me that that is an issue in America. And I think it's very relevant to the point you made about the worldwide sort of scope of this, is in most countries, informal settlements are like something they consider, talk about ranked in government statistics. But here it's like America can't admit that people are forming these informal settlements because they can't get housing. And a lot of this clearing these encampments is really about changing the narrative about what this country is like.
I agree with you. You see, even on a local level, like the benches where they have spikes and stuff on them, you know, it could be a bench in front of a church and they'll put something on the bench so somebody can't lay down and sleep, you know, and all of that, all that is about image and comfort. And I think a lot of what we experience in today's cities is designed to give us comfort. And I think it's because there's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on about what's going on in the world and our role in it and, you know, what we do on a daily basis. And we don't like seeing certain things. We just want to be comfortable.
Bob Schlehuber, your thoughts on this issue? I know actually in your neighborhood there was an issue of a bench being made unsleepable.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to admit failure if you're these city officials and they can't admit failure. I mean, the Washington, D.C. budget has dramatically increased over the last 4 years with foreign investment, with the economy bouncing back nationwide, globally, and there's surpluses now running the district. The problem is that these people either, A, just don't care to fix the problem and they want to pat themselves on the back for putting legislation out there without actually seeing any changes in the numbers, or simply they don't know what they're doing and they don't have the proper creative approaches towards addressing not only the person not having a home, but them not having daily action and proper nutrition and proper education and all of those different health issues that come along with being homeless. And I don't think our city officials are going to be able to admit that type of failure. To be able to improve, to be able to work out these issues, we have to humble ourselves and say, I might not have the right answers. Mm. I might not know exactly what I'm going to do, but I'm going to go out, I'm going to hear and listen for people. And there's a complete failure of the elected officials in the city to actually sit and be hands-on with these people that need these services. So then when you talk about, is the city run well? Of course it's not run well because they're not actually able to humble themselves and talk with these people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I don't think they want to make it work. I think that if you wanted to make it work, because I'm just going to be real. And, you know, whatever, there may be some council members and staff listening to this, but, you know, hopefully you hear this and take it to heart. There's no creativity at D.C. government. Like, no one is sitting around and thinking, like, okay, we got a problem. Like, let's just go with the homeless disencampment piece. So these people are saying categorically they don't want to move. They prefer to live right there. So if what you really were thinking, like, if you really were thinking, let's be creative, like, okay, how can we turn this around? And how can we say, okay, cool, can we get some services in here? Can we get some sort of shower-type facilities? How can we get some bathroom-type facilities? Is there a little land close by? Could we help them grow a little food, you know what I'm saying, so they could be more self-sufficient?
And in case they are listening, let's not – I mean, maybe not blame them entirely, but blame – what education are these people – what university is teaching a public policy program on radical approaches towards community building and housing?
Nah, they can go
I'm going to have to push back, Bob. Like I deal with people in this city – who would be willing to build affordable housing for families. I'm talking about the stadium deal right now. They're willing to build affordable housing. I don't know if you guys have heard that. It's, you know, multiple bedroom affordable family housing.
I have not heard that. Is the basketball stadium or soccer stadium?
Well, the soccer stadium. They're willing to build that, you know, as like a push to their project. But it's on top of a toxic waste dump. They haven't remediated the site. These people know that. This is who we're talking about. These people are wicked. So it's not a matter of do they understand? They know what they're doing. They have their values. We have ours. They're different. And that's what it is.
I agree. I mean, when I was curious about land use, I just went and like started picking up books and seeing what are people doing in different places, what's working, what are countries that I think are basically okay countries, what do they do there? And it just seems like there's no push. I mean, even like the U.S. Congress, which I don't think is great, I feel like you see way more Congress people who just kind of throw stuff against the wall, who are like, oh, you know what? I'm just going to come up with some little crazy idea and throw it out there. Good or bad idea now. It could be terrible ideas, but there just seems to be more of like, let me try to think of something unique where it's just so, and I think maybe local government in general, even though it's supposed to be an area where people can innovate, you know, it takes so much less money to corrupt someone. I think it's also a lot easier for these cats to be captured. Like when you're in Congress, everybody is coming for you. Everyone's giving you money. So you could like conceivably just like alienate one interest group and go to another interest group. But say a D.C., you can't just alienate real estate developers. They'll come for you. New York, you know, Wall Street. So unless you're a person who in your core has already decided I'm not going to sell out to these people in the lead up to it, you know, you're more likely than not to be brought into the mainstream stream.
Well, I think government works, Eugene. Mm. It works for who it works for. Mm. And regardless of the rah-rah and how people come out and, you know, they maybe even protest. But, you know, if you're of a certain class and you're of a certain education level, government is working for you. I mean, whether or not you protest that or like pledge allegiance to me on 16th and V in Southeast, that's a different issue. But government is working for you.
Mm.
It's not working for us. And so I think that like that needs to be addressed in a way. And I don't know. I don't know how it gets addressed, but it needs to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's like an original sin kind of thing. Right. I mean, like if the government is not set up to do what you want it to do, you can't. You could be mad about it, but you got to approach it a different way. I mean, I'm curious what you think about that, Bob, because I mean, the way like reforms are always approached in America is like, well, America's basically good and we just have to like tweak the system because like no one ever knew that it was going to have this terrible side effect, as opposed to like, well, look, they set this thing up to be totally ridiculous. So we got to overhaul the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, it will be interesting to see here in the nation's capital if public financing of campaigns gets passed. And I think that's going to be kind of your first effort. I think we always need to remind ourselves as the people that are abused the most by the system have the least amount of resources to actually fight back against the resource. So when people – so many liberals and a lot of progressive Democrats right now constantly say, well, you should run for office. Why don't you just run for office? That's the solution. Just run for office. Like as if I could run for office and I'm going to get a $300,000, $400,000 check just to be like a city council member to be possibly viable when these people are working two, three jobs every day. And your point's well heard. The council members in Washington, D.C. are part-time jobs, and you're absolutely right. If they wanted to go buy a book, they could find time to read their book. They're getting six figures, part-time jobs. They have plenty of extra hours. They're not on their feet all day working in some kitchen trying to, like, start the revolution. These people, I'm going to go back with what you guys are saying. It's willful ignorance, and it's a different set of moral values. Do we have to start bringing them to church and preaching at these people? Or do we have, what is it that's going to take it? Is it a straight on fight in battle, or do you try to transform these people and they're not moving?
I think a lot of it's self-preservation, right? Mm. Like these guys are so far from the community. I think a lot of it is laziness because DC has this sort of demographics where if you get on the feet and try on white, prove this, you can get out.
From Ward 8 in DC.
Yeah, you can get out and you can get elected. But I think a lot of it is laziness. They would rather align themselves with developers and just get the easy money, send out some flyers, and not be accountable to anybody but them. And that's it. That's an easy thing to do because their agenda stays the same. Our stuff shifts, you know, and some people may want this, some people want that. They just want money.
Right.
And they have a way of making money and they can tell you what you need to do to make them that money.
And they got the legislative
writers
to it. You wanted some legislation.
Exactly.
Here's the right legislation. It's done. Introduce these three bills.
That's easy. And so we've gone through that with our Ward 8 councilman. I mean, you know, there's been communication between them and the activist community just to like, you know, connect on some stuff and like, yeah, what can we get through? Mm. You know, like y'all argue and rah-rah and everything, but like, where are you? We need legislation, like, you know, but for them in those communities, they have like people from Harvard, consultants, Deloitte, you know what I mean? Like
everybody.
Like here, like write this legislation for us and it's what we need to do to get paid. And they're just like, okay, I saw it. I went to go testify about the African-American office or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was there and I mean, half the people testifying, it was almost like an advertisement for whatever they're trying to push. So they're like, yeah, if you need any advice on what this office could do, like, you know, come hit me up. I got a degree from so-and-so and, you know, I studied this. And like, that's half the testimony.
Right.
And
right.
I think you got to remember, too, that so much of the efforts by developers and by some of these corporate interests, by foreign developers and investors, they're 15, 20 years into the future with their plans, right?
Yeah.
And the only thing that so many of us in the grassroots and activist community can do is be reactionary. When people finally see it, until they're finally having their stuff thrown out of the curb, then people can finally say, oh my God, this is happening. It's hard to convince people and have them see that into the future vision when they're trying to struggle just to survive today. Mm. But when you're not struggling, you can start looking into the next day and the next day and all of a sudden 20 years. So it's not like a starting point for everyone and say, now fight for the morals and values of the city. Man, it's like you're working against time and place.
Yeah, well, certainly I'll give you a pro tip to anyone here, anywhere, at least in America, who's concerned about gentrification in their community. You have to pay attention to your zoning process because that's where they set this stuff up years and years ahead of time. They have to get approval well ahead of time. And the more stuff you got to change, steward, the more public information that is required to be issued. Now, it's all issued below ground, but if you follow zoning and if you follow like whoever is working on utilities, you can find a lot out about these big construction projects, big things you got to stretch out. Now, there's way more you got to learn about the process itself per se, but at least you'll know what's coming down the pike because when you see it, it's too late. Like once they start building it, it's already too late. All the legal pieces, more or less, I mean, outside of squatting, which is certainly relevant, are now kind of beside more or less out of the way. But if you start early, you at least have some sense of what's going on. And that's how they trick people, I think, really, is they make you think that the real issue is the council or the mayor or the oversight when it's really these regulatory
boards. I think we're also seeing problems in Washington, D.C. around the ideas of who is the community. It's so easy in how cities are structured for civic associations or little neighborhood groups all of a sudden to kind of get one person that doesn't have got a little too much time on their hands and a little too much of an inflated ego all of a sudden say, I speak for the entire neighborhood. And when you have certain laws that don't put a certain threshold or responsibility on what that equals, certain people are able to abuse the community and its people.
Yeah, no, I think those are good points. Obviously, we could talk about this all day long. I think we're going to have to leave it there today here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. and also 105.5 FM live here. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and we'll see you next week.
By Any Means Necessary.